He stiffened with the shock of his name, and they lay, locked like lovers, legs entangled, their lower bodies pressed together, both panting wildly and smeared with his blood, staring at each other wordlessly. Abruptly, he released her and stood up. He pulled the mask off his head, and his tousled golden locks fell about his ears and tumbled down his forehead into his eyes, as he wrapped the mask tightly around his mutilated wrist. He realized that it was seriously injured. The tendons and bone were exposed, and the flesh was mangled and tattered where she had chewed it. Bright scarlet arterial blood soaked through the white cloth immediately and dripped into the sand. Santaine pulled herself into a sitting position and watched him. The engine of the Daimler had stalled, and there was silence except for their breathing. "Why are you doing this?" she whispered. "You know why." He knotted the cloth with his teeth, and suddenly she flung herself sideways and reached desperately into the cab, her fingers scrabbling again for the pistol. She touched it but could not get her fingers around the butt before he pulled her away and pushed her over backwards into the sand. He picked up the pistol and unclipped the lanyard. He wound the lanyard around his forearm as a tourniquet and grunted with satisfaction as the seep of blood shriveled. "Where are they?" He looked down at her where she lay. "What are you talking about?" He stooped and looked into the cab of the Daimler, then pulled out the black Japan dispatch box. "Keys?" he asked. She stared back at him defiantly, and he squatted and placed the box firmly in the sand, then stepped back a pace. He cocked the pistol and fired a single shot. The report was stunning in the desert silence, and Santaine's eardrums buzzed with the memory. The bullet had torn the lock of the dispatch box away, and a circle of the black paint flaked from the lid, leaving the metal beneath shiny and bright. Lotha pocketed the pistol and knelt and lifted the lid. The case was filled with small packages, each neatly wrapped in brown paper and sealed with red wax. He picked out one package, favouring his injured hand, and read aloud the inscription in Twentyman Jones's ornate, old-fashioned penmanship. 156 pieces, total 382 carats. He tore open the heavy cartridge paper with his teeth and shook out a sprinkle of gems into the palm of his injured hand. In the white sunlight, they had that peculiar soapy sheen of uncut diamonds. "Very pretty," he murmured, and dropped the loose stones into his pocket. He packed the torn parcel back into the dispatch case and closed the lid. "I knew you were a murderer," she said. "I never thought you a common thief. You stole my boats and my company. Don't talk to me about thieves." He tucked the dispatch case under his arm and stood up. He went round to the boot of the Daimler and managed to open it a crack, even though the vehicle was inverted, and he checked the contents. "Good," he said. "You've had the sense to bring spare water. 20 gallons will last you a week, but they'll find you before then. Abrahams is sending out an escort to meet you. I intercepted the instruction from Twentyman Jones." "You swine," she whispered. "I will cut the telegraph wires before I leave. As soon as that happens, they will realize at both ends that something is wrong. You'll be all right." "Oh, God, I hate you." "Stay with the vehicle. That's the first law of desert survival. Don't go wandering off. They will rescue you in about 2 days, and I will have 2 days' start." I thought I hated you before, but now I know the real meaning of the word, she said. I could have taught it to you, he said quietly, as he picked up the abandoned shotgun out of the sand. I came to know it well, over the years that I was rearing your son. Then again, when you came back into my life, only to tear down everything I ever dreamed about and worked for. He swung the shotgun like an axe against one of the boulders. The butt shattered, but he went on until it was bent and battered and useless. He dropped it. Then he slung the Mauser over his shoulder and transferred the dispatch case to his other hand. He held the injured hand in its blood-wet wrapping against his chest. Clearly, the pain was fierce. He had paled under his deep bronze tan, and there was a catch in his voice as he went on. I tried not to hurt you. If you hadn't struggled... He broke off. We will not meet again. Ever. Goodbye, Santaine. We will meet again, she contradicted him. You know me well enough. You must realize that I will not rest until I have full retribution for this day's work. He nodded. I know you will try. He turned away. Lothar, she called sharply, and then softened her voice when he turned back. I'll make you a bargain. Your company and your boats free of all debt for my diamonds. A bad bargain, he smiled sadly. By now the plant and boats are worth nothing, while your diamonds, plus £50,000 and my promise not to report this affair to the police. She tried to keep the edge of desperation out of her voice. Last time it was I who was begging. Do you recall? No, Santaine. Even if I wanted, I could not go back now. I've burned my bridges. He thought about the horses but could not tell her. No bargain, Santaine. Now I must go. Half the diamonds. Leave half, Lothar. Why? For the love we once shared. He laughed bitterly. You will have to give me a better reason than that. All right, she said. If you take them, you will destroy me, Lothar. I cannot survive their loss. Already I am finely drawn. I will be utterly ruined. As I was when you took my boats. He turned and trudged through the sand to the bank, and she stood up. Lothar de la Rey, she shouted after him. You refused my offer. Then take my oath instead. I swear, and I call on God and all his saints to witness, I swear that I will never rest again until you swing by the neck from the gallows. He did not look back, but she saw him flinch his head at the threat. Then, cradling his injured wrist and burdened by the rifle and the dispatch case, he climbed the high bank and was gone. She sank down on the sand, and a wave of reaction swept over her. She found she was shaking wildly and uncontrollably. Despondency and humiliation and despair came at her in waves like a storm surf battering an unresisting beach, sweeping it over it and then sucking back and gathering and rushing forward again. She found she was weeping, thick, slow tears dissolving the clots of his drying blood from her lips and chin. And her tears disgusted her as much as the taste of blood at the back of her throat. Disgust gave her the strength and resolution to pull herself to her feet and cross to the Daimler. Miraculously, the water bag was still on its bracket. She washed away the blood and the tears. She gargled the taste of his blood from her mouth and spat it pink into the sand, and she thought of following him. He had taken the revolver, and the shotgun was a battered and twisted piece of steel. "Not yet," she whispered, "but very soon. I have given you my oath on it, Lothar de la Rey." Instead, she went to the boot of the inverted Daimler. She had to scoop away the sand with her hands before she could get it fully open. She took out the 2 10-gallon cans of water and the canisters of industrial diamonds, carried them to the shade of the bank, and buried them in the sand to hide them and to keep the water as cool as possible. Then she returned to the Daimler and impatiently unpacked the other survival equipment that she always carried, suddenly deadly afraid that the telegraph tap had been offloaded or forgotten. But it was there, in the toolbox, with the wheeljack and spanners. She lugged the reel of wire and the haversack containing the tap as she followed Lothar's tracks up the bank and found where he had tethered his horse. He said he was going to cut the telegraph. She shaded her eyes and peered along the river course. He should have guessed I would have carried a tap with me. He isn't going to get his 2 days' start. She picked out the line of telegraph poles cutting across the road loop and the bend of the river. The tracks of Lothar's horse followed the bank, and she broke into a run and trotted along them. She saw the break in the wires from 200 yards off. The severed copper wires dangled to earth in 2 lazy inverted parabolas, and she quickened her pace. When she reached the spot where the telegraph line crossed the river and looked down the bank, she immediately recognized the remnants of Lothar's camp. Sand had been hastily kicked over the fire, but the embers still smoldered. She dropped the coil of wire and the haversack and scrambled down the bank. She found the dugout and realized that more than one man had been living here for some considerable time. There were 3 mattresses of cut grass. 3. She puzzled over it for a few moments and then worked it out. He has his bastard with him. She still couldn't bring herself to think of Manfred as her son. And the other one will be Svart Hendrik. He and Lothar are inseparable. She ducked from the dugout and stood for a moment undecided. It would take time to rig the tap to the severed wires, and it was vitally important to find out which way Lothar had ridden, if she was to set the pursuit on him before he got clear. She made her decision. I'll rig the telegraph after I know which way to send them. It was unlikely he would head east into the Kalahari. There was nothing out there. He'll head back towards Vindhoek, she guessed, and she made her first cast in that direction. The area around the camp was thickly trodden with spoor of horse and men. They had been here for at least 2 weeks, she judged. Only her bushman training enabled her to make sense of the tangled tracks. They didn't go out that way, she decided at last. Then they must have headed south, for Gobabis and the Orange River. She made her next cast in that direction, circling the southern perimeter of the camp, and when she found no spoor fresher than the previous day, she looked to the north. Surely not. She was confused. There is nothing out there before the Okavango River and Portuguese territory. The horses will never make it across the wastes of bushman land. Nevertheless, she made her next cast across that northern segment, and almost immediately cut the outgoing spoor, fresh and cleanly printed in the soft earth. 3 riders, each leading a spare horse, not an hour ago. Lothar must be taking the northern route after all. He is crazy, or he's worked out something. She followed the fresh spoor for a mile to make certain that he had not doubled or backtracked. The spoor ran straight and unwavering into the shimmering heat mists of the northern wastes, and she shivered as she remembered what it was like out there. "He must be crazy," she whispered. "But I know he isn't. He's going for the Angola border. That's his old base from the ivory poaching days. If he reaches the river, we'll never see him again. He has friends over there, the Portuguese traders who bought his ivory. This time, Lothar will have £1,000,000 of diamonds in his pocket and the wide world to choose from. I have to catch him before he gets across." Her spirits quailed at the enormity of the idea, and she felt despondency come at her again. "He has prepared this carefully. Everything is in his favour. We'll never catch him." She fought off the beast of despair. "Yes, we will. We have to. I have to outwit and beat him. I simply have to, just to survive." She whirled and ran back to the abandoned camp. The severed telegraph wires drooped to earth, and she gathered the ends and clipped the bridging wires from the coil to them, drawing them just taut enough to keep them clear of the earth. She put her tap into the circuit and screwed the terminals to the pack of dry cell batteries. The batteries had been renewed before she left Windhoek. They should still be full of life. For a dreadful moment her mind went blank, and she could not remember a single letter of the Morse code. Then it returned with a rush, and she hammered quickly on the brass key. "Juno for Vant. Acknowledge." For long seconds there was only echoing silence in her headphones. Then the startling beep of the reply, "Vant for Juno. Go ahead." She tried to pick the short word and terse abridged phrase as she told Twentyman Jones of the robbery and gave her position, and then went on. "Negotiate standoff with strikers as recovery of goods mutually essential. Stop. Take truck to northern tip of Ochi Pan and locate Bushman encampment in Mongongo Forest. Stop. Bush leader named Kui. Stop. Tell Kui, Nam child Kalea. Repeat, Nam child Kalea." And she gave thanks that the word Kalea bore phonetic rendition into the Roman alphabet and required neither the complicated tonals nor the clicks of the Bushman language. Kalea was the distress call, the cry for help that no clan member could ignore. "Bring Kui with you," she went on, and continued with her further instructions. And when she signed off, Twentyman Jones acknowledged and then sent, "Are you safe and unharmed? Query, Vant." "Affirmative, ends, Juno." She mopped the sweat off her face with a yellow silk scarf. She was sitting in the direct rays of the sun. Then she flexed her fingers and bent once more to the keyboard and tapped out the call sign of her operator in the offices of Courtney Mining and Finance Company in Windhoek. The acknowledgement was prompt. Obviously, the operator had been following her transmission to Twentyman Jones, but she asked, "Have you copied previous?" "Affirmative," he tapped back. "Relay previous to Administrator Colonel Blaine Malcolm S. plus following for Malcolm S. Quote, request cooperation in capture of culprits and recovery of stolen goods. Stop. Do you have report on large number stolen horses or purchase of horses by one Lothar de la Rey within last 3 months? Respond soonest. Ends Juno." The distant operator acknowledged and then continued, "Pettifogger for Juno." A.B. must have been summoned to the telegraph office the minute they received their first transmission. "Greatly concerned for your safety. Stop. Remain your present position. Stop." And Santaine exclaimed irritably, "I sucked that egg long ago, A.B." But she copied the rest of it. "Armed escort left Windhoek 5 a.m. Instant. Stop. Should reach you early tomorrow. Stop. Stand by for Malcolm S. Ends. Pettifogger." The wires were long enough to allow her to move the keyboard into the strip of shade below the bank, and while she waited, she gave all her concentration to the task ahead. Certain facts were apparent, and the first of these was that they were never going to catch Lothar de la Rey in a stern chase. He had too long a lead, and he was going into country over which he had travelled and hunted for half his life. He knew it better than any living white man, better than even she did, but not better than little Kui. "We have to work out his route and cut him off. And we will have to use horses. Trucks will be useless over that terrain. Lothar knows that. He is banking on that. He will choose a route that trucks can never follow." She closed her eyes and visualized a map of the Northern Territory, that vast, forbidding sweep of desert called Bushmanland. She only knew of surface water at two points. One, the place she always thought of as Elephant Pan, and the other, a deep seep below a hillock of shale. They were secret Bushman places, both of which old Awah, her adopted grandfather, had shown her 15 years before. She wondered if she could find either waterhole again, but she was certain that Lothar knew them and could ride directly to them. He probably knew of other waterholes that she did not. The beep of the telegraph disturbed her, and she reached for it eagerly. "Malcolm S. for Juno. Police report theft of 26 horses from military remount depot, Okanhanja, 3rd of last month. Stop. Only two animals recovered. Stop. State your further requirements." "I was right. Lothar has set up staging posts across the desert," she exclaimed. And she closed her eyes and tried to visualize a map of the Northern Territory, estimating distances and times. At last, she opened her eyes again and bent to the telegraph key. "Convinced fugitives attempting to reach Okavango River direct. Stop. Assemble small mobile force of desert-trained men with spare horses. Stop. Rendezvous, Kalkrand Mission Station soonest. Stop. I will join you with Bushman trackers.